Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Sad, but inevitable. That was my reaction to the news that Hugh Edwards and the BBC have come to a parting of ways. Hugh Edwards' resignation will certainly come as a relief to the corporation. It's now free to appoint a new main presenter for the general election coverage, going head-to-head with Channel 4's new signing, Emily Maitlis. And as it continues to cut costs and close posts, as well as bearing down on presenters' salaries, the BBC will no longer have to face attacks from the usual suspects, who would have said that the BBC was paying a presenter massive sums to do nothing. Hugh Edwards has, I think, no future in news and current affairs broadcasting, but if he recovers and apologises to those he's hurt, then it's not impossible to see him return to some form of broadcasting in the future. I hope so. Moving on from tragedy to comedy, I'm a bit cross. The Now Show is no more. It has become The Then Show. After 25 years, it's been cancelled by Radio 4, and Steve Punt and Hugh Dennis will be doing other series for the network. I preferred it to the News Quiz, at least until Andy Saltzman shook the latter up and made it his own. What I loved about The Now Show was the fact that it took intelligent potshots at everybody and everything, and had no discernible bias. It was also unafraid to be just plain, wonderfully silly. And the two main presenters, Punt and Dennis, obviously got on. They weren't competing with each other for attention. So, why was The Now Show cancelled? And what will Punt and Dennis do next? Who better to ask than Steve Punt himself? Steve Punt, thanks for coming on the podcast. When I heard your show was being cancelled, I was cross, because I love it. Were you cross?
Well, we were disappointed, I think, rather than cross. Because weirdly, one of the things about a topical show is that you don't really notice the time pass, because it's a bit like doing an exam. You're sort of so focused on the show for 3-4 days a week that the series sort of drift past in a haze of news stories that are only in your head for 3 or 4 days. And I don't think we'd really registered that it had been sitting there for 25 years. And when they said, you know, you're getting a bit old for doing this sort of thing, we thought, are we? Because the strange thing is that when The Now Show started in 1998, we were precisely the age that they were looking for. We were told, you know, what we want is a topical show that will be aimed at attracting listeners in their 30s. And at the time, we were in our mid-30s, and we were exactly the demographic that they wanted. And we're no longer that demographic. We are now, ironically, exactly where Radio 4's average listener is. But, of course, the perennial problem for Radio 4, literally for as long as I have worked for them, has been how to attract a new generation of listeners.
But it seems a strange assumption to make that actually in order to attract younger listeners, you have to have younger presenters. Well, it's crazy, obviously, if the whole network is full of old people, as indeed when I was there, very old people, I suppose. But it seems a strange idea, because you had, there was no sense in listening to the programme that you were losing your enthusiasm for it. I mean, it seemed to me, anyway, as funny as it ever was. It was a particularly, I thought, good last edition on Friday.
Well, I think, I mean, I always felt that topical comedy is not like pop music or even drama. It's not something where youth is actually that much of an advantage, because I think when it comes to current affairs, it actually helps. What you find as you get older is that you've seen it all before and you start to realise everything, almost everything in politics is quite cyclical. Yes. And you can put things in perspective, you know, and I sometimes find at meetings where we have some writers who are substantially younger and they'll be worrying about something in the news and we will go, well, this happened in 1988 or, you know, this is exactly what happened in 1990. I was talking about 1996 recently because we were talking about the upcoming election and the Tories in the polls and Labour in the polls. And I was saying, well, you know, this really feels like 1996. And of course, I looked around the room and I was the only person there who remembered 1996.
Nobody there remembered John Major and his soapbox or anything like that.
I don't think so. I mean, the current producer is 27. So she was barely born when the show started, and that's another odd thing. It's not like the show lacks a younger perspective, because very frequently the stand-ups will be in their 20s or 30s. The producer is always really young. Some of the music acts are really young. So it's really just us sort of sitting there going, I remember this back in the 80s.
Yeah. Trouble with all this, Steve, is you are legally, it's possible that you were legally, you could be my son. So don't feel very old, will you?
That's the other thing, is we thought, we're not that old by Radio 4 standards.
No, not by my standards either. I mean, how did they tell you in the end? I got a cup of coffee and a sort of, well, thank you very much and goodbye. But that was about it, I think. Or did I get croissant? I can't remember. What were you offered? Anything interesting? Nice lunch?
It was lunch, yeah. It was lunch, and then a sort of quietly leading question about, so how do you feel about the show? We were given plenty of notice. I mean, this is the thing. We had known for a long time. I mean, we had 2 years notice, whereas the Radio 4 only actually released the news as the series started. So although people found out basically at the beginning of March, we had known for ages. So in fact, we'd been, not only were we fully aware that was the last series, but we spent last year developing and piloting a new show, and sort of planning ahead.
And I want to tell you, I have got some more Radio 4 commissions, and I want to talk to you about that a little bit later, if I may. But what did you do? What did it feel like after the last recording? Because, you know, I'm sure that when you're doing it, you're totally focused. Then you end the recording, and you think, well, that's the last one. Did you just go back and have a cup of tea or Bovril or whatever it was? No?
No, there was a little BBC drinks do afterwards. As Hugh pointed out, it was literally just crisps. Someone had gone to Marks and Spencer's and they'd bought one of every flavour of crisps. So he made a little speech thanking the BBC for the magnificent spread.
By the way, it is. I didn't get anything at all. So if getting crisps, that's a real mark of honour.
Yes, it was crisps.
I mean, one of the things, though, which obviously everybody listening to this programme would know, was the sort of friendship that you and Hugh had, and the way in which you never tried to outdo each other, and you had such a relaxed tone together, that I think that spread, and that's one of the reasons why you were so successful. I mean, you've been together now for 40 years, haven't you? Didn't you meet at Footlights?
Yeah, we've known each other for 40 years. 39 years of actually working together, because before that we were in larger casts together. We were,
and you weren't in the Mary Whitehouse Experience, weren't you?
Yes,
four of you, and then
yes,
you
know. that started in 1989. The interesting thing about that show was that it was on Radio 1 when it was on the radio. It wasn't Radio 4, and it was the culmination of a long period in the 80s of young comedians, which we then were, pushing to get some comedy onto Radio 1, and finally succeeded in 1988 with a series called Hey Radio, which was a sort of cabaret show with Patrick Marber, no less, hosting.
Ah, the great dramatist, yeah.
Yes. And then Radio 1 said, yeah, we quite like that, but we'd prefer a regular cast, I think. So out of that, they selected people who could write as well as perform.
Is it cheaper for them that way? You get two for the price of one.
I guess it probably is slightly, but also there's a style to a writer-performer show. It tends to have more of a voice to it, whereas a show that has a group of writers and then people who read their words, it's a slightly different feel, because people who are reading their own words or who are sort of communicating their own point of view or their own perspective tends to give a show, I think, a little bit more sense of itself.
I mean, I was wondering about when did you feel it once the show was getting running, that you really had a sense of its identity and the way it was structured? Because, of course, it's a number of contributions from different people and could have been in different forms or structures, whatever. I mean, was it clear to you from the beginning how the show would work? Or did you have to tinker with it to get that right feel?
Well, the thing about the Now Show is that it never really had a format beyond the people making it. So the producer, the initial producer, Bill Dare, the extent to which he formatted it was by choosing three or four groups of people who he thought were consistent and who could write and produce, because you have to keep producing stuff in a topical show. And then his attitude was, well, let's see what they come up with. I mean, Hugh and I had quite a lot of experience of topical comedy before the Now Show started. I used to actually write the Review of the Week's News for Loose Ends for Ned Sherrin. I co-wrote it for a long time with a guy called Pete Sinclair, and then I wrote it on my own for a while. And I also used to write for Weekending on Radio 4, and I wrote for Spitting Image. I wrote for Jasper Carrot. So I'd done quite a lot of topical comedy, and Bill knew that. So he thought, well, you've done all that sort of apprenticeship, topical stuff. Let's see what you come up with.
But you came up with this two-hander at the front, which has worked so well for a long time, and often there'd be musical element. But
yeah, I wanted a song in the show, because another thing to bear in mind is that one of the things behind the Now Show that we always were conscious of was that we wanted it to sound as different to the news quiz as possible. You don't want to be directly compared with a show that's they've been there for 30 years. It's one of the best-loved shows on the network. So we always wanted it to be fully scripted, so there's no chat, and we wanted a song, so and sketches and sound effects and funny voices, because all of those things make it different from the news quiz, which of course is a conversational show. So some of that format sort of came out of wanting to make it distinctive from the shows that already existed on the network.
Did you find it got more difficult as years go by? Because, you know, in the past, we wait for Friday, no problem. But nowadays, with podcasts and other things and quite a lot of topical comedy, or some anyway, available very quickly, did you ever worry that by the time you got on the air at the end of the week, you might be a bit late with stories?
Yes. I mean, when we were talking about the last show, when we were looking back and saying, well, you know, what's changed over the lifetime of the show, I think the way that news is consumed and distributed was literally the biggest thing that's changed. Because when the show started in 1998, the writers' meeting, we would have a big pile of newspapers on the table, and virtually the whole agenda of the show was taken from printed newspapers, whereas the news now comes from everywhere. It pops up on your phone, it pops up everywhere, and the jokes follow. You know, the jokes are being tweeted literally minutes later. So yeah, I mean, it is harder in the sense that a 2 or 3 day wait for a show, a lot of jokes have been done in that time. But I think we felt in the end it was quite healthy, because it would mean that you wouldn't go for the first joke you thought of. You thought, we're going to have to think a bit harder. We're going to have to sort of you sort of discard the first two jokes that you think of, because everyone else has thought of those. And then you sort of move into more interesting areas. And of course, the Now Show didn't tend to go quite as head on at the news. Most topical shows do a list of news stories and they talk about them one by one. Whereas we always thought we would try and look for themes in the news or things that somehow link together the stories of the week. So we always kind of thought of it more like a Sunday paper, if you see what I mean.
And it also seemed to me, though, that you could make the I mean, it's always argument, you know, about right-wing, left-wing comedy and whatever. But there was a time, for example, with the news quiz, not now, where they did seem to be, anyway, to be quite a large number of people coming from, let us say, a left-wing perspective. It was possible to identify that. I don't think you could now. And I don't take a lot of what it's said to be right-wing comedy, because, you know, comedy is often, satirical comedy is often about, is usually about power, and therefore the joke's about the government in power, and if it's a Conservative Party for a long time, then they're going to be the butt of most of the jokes. But did you ever worry about whether you were doing right, left-wing comedy, and whatever you were doing? Did you have any political ambitions yourself with your comedy?
Not really. I mean, I think Hugh and I shamelessly are just more interested in where it's funny. But I think that in itself made the Now Show slightly unusual, because I think a lot of people who do topical comedy are quite political. And there was an era on the news quiz where it was very clear that people like Linda Smith and Jeremy Hardy were quite openly and avowedly, they were left-wing people. They always had been. I mean, I used to know Jeremy when he was doing a sitcom for Radio 4 called Unnatural Acts, which later became At Home with the Hardys. And, you know, there was a circle of people who used to sell Socialist Worker at Brixton Tube Station. And,
Mentioned Mark Steele.
Yeah, Mark Steele as well. And Mark Thomas as well. They were all people who were on the circuit when we started, and they were all people who had absolutely no bones about the fact that they were political comics. They all came out of the 80s, so they all came as part of that sort of backlash in the 80s against Thatcherism, which was almost universal among the young, to be honest. And the circuit, the comedy circuit that we joined in the mid-late 80s, was very left-wing. And, because it was mostly, it was a Tory government. It was a Tory government who were fairly confrontational in some ways. And so that translated a lot into comedy. It was also very clear on Saturday Live with Ben Elton, you know, and the famous, a little bit of satire there era. And
all about Thatch.
He was always on about Thatch.
Yeah. Did you feel, though, as a result of all this, when you were on the circuit yourself, that people were saying, you ought to be more political, you ought to be more directly political? Did they ever sort of challenge you in that way?
Well, there was a little bit of that. And I mean, that's what's always ironic when people assume that because you do comedy or air for your left wing. We used to be sort of regarded as quite trivial, I think, when we were on the circuit, because we used to do silly sketches, a lot of verbal stuff. We used to finish when we were in London, with a really sort of two Ronnies-like sketch in which we got the names of 65 tube stations into 3.5 minutes. And nobody else was doing that kind of thing. And so we were originally, I think, sort of renowned for not being political.
And yet you were, in the sense that when I listened to it, you weren't political in the sense of coming from one perspective, but you've consistently made very funny and sharp jokes about everybody in politics. I mean, that was for me, and I don't pretend I have to say this now. It was my favourite show. I preferred you to, at least until the recent incarnation of the news quiz. I really loved that show because I never knew who you were going to go for. But when you did go for them, you went for in a very intelligent and funny way, where there was an element of predictability with comedy elsewhere.
Well, I think
you were political in that sense, were you?
Yes. Obviously. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's two things. The one thing is that when comics are political, as we were saying earlier, Mark Thomas, Mark Steele, Jeremy Hardy, the thing is they can be brilliantly funny, but there is always an element of predictability because you know the angle they're going to come from. Whereas I think Hugh was saying to me the other day, he said, I still don't think I know how you vote, even after all these years. And I think because we are not overtly political, we could go for everybody, hopefully. And I always tend to think that people in politics, people who are very political, always take the attitude of, if you're not for us, you're a Guinness. So that not only are you supposed to avoid doing jokes about their side, you're supposed to actively attack the other side. And if you don't do that, they think you're biased. But I think that bias is a really difficult thing because I'm not, a lot of the people who are accusing you of bias are biased themselves. And I'm not really sure that someone who is a vociferous supporter of one political party is in any position to judge whether something is biased or not. But that's another question.
Let alone if something's funny. But if I just ask you, though, about radio comedy, because, you know, when one looks back at Radio 4, I mean, it has a fabulous history of comedy or whatever, and it still does wonderful, wonderful things. I mean, Tales from a Long Marriage, for example, that is sensationally good, I think. But, I mean, on the whole, what you have seen quite a radical change. Money available. There were never, you never paid very well for appearing on radio. But in many ways, there were no older alternatives. And you could say it was a good way of putting your wares on offer, and perhaps a television series with more money or a stand-up career would follow. Now, with the podcast, with people's ability to do their own thing directly with the public, do you think that the days of radio comedy not numbered, but it's much more difficult and now much less important than it used to be?
I think it's a strange thing, but I think if you think of it as audio comedy, which I think increasingly is how it's sort of seen, I actually think audio comedy is in a far, far better place now than it was when we started in radio, because there's no question in the 80s radio was regarded as a bit of a backwater for comedy, and you would either go there in the hope you'd be spotted by television or to sort of cruise along to retirement. And in fact, Bill Dare, who set up the Now Show, used to have a joke that he used to do in warm-up when he was producing shows. He would introduce to the audience before, and he would always say, he would always do this joke, which went, they say you do radio twice in your career, once on the way up and once on the way down. Good to be back. And in the 80s and sort of first half of the 90s, I think there was some truth in that. But what has happened in the 21st century is that the advent of downloads and podcasting and being able to put stuff on your own device and listen to it on the tube. And that was always a weird thing. I would see people on the tube on Monday morning and it would say BBC Radio The Now Show that they were listening to. And I think it's really a revitalised radio comedy. I suspect that the audience that's aware of comedy on the radio is much bigger now than it was when the show started.
But they will include you in the future, of course, because, I mean, what have you got coming up there on Radio 4? What about the new series that you and Hugh are going to do? What's that about?
Well, yes, we wanted to devise something, firstly, that wasn't about the week's news, and secondly, that was, you know, perhaps more modern in style, in the sense that it's more chatty and it will work as a podcast as well as a radio show, because there's been an interesting development, I think, the last few years, because initially podcasts were often not edited very much. They were sort of produced by people at home on laptops, and they were quite long and rambly sometimes. And whereas I think what's happened in the last few years is that there's a lot more professionalism gone into how they're edited and how they're made up. And that, in a sense, has played into the BBC's hands, because that's what's what they're really, really good at. Production, editing, learning how to structure stuff. So we wanted to make something that would sound like a modern show, but would actually use all those things that the BBC is great at and have a proper producer who's been trained and all that kind of thing. So what it is, it's a sort of formatted chat with a guest, and our format is based on connections. So, you know, when you look back at your internet history after you've Googled something and you think, how on earth did I get from there to there? So you watch a film and then you Google the person who was playing the bloke with the lawnmower and you think, oh, what were they in? I've seen them in something. So you start off with that. And then an hour later, you're reading about Easter Island statues, or you're reading about, you know, Sydney Cricket Stadium or something. And you think, how on earth did I get from looking that up to this? And what we want is a show that has that feel to it, of a conversation that goes from, that sort of follows this inexplicable inner logic of a conversation with your friends, where you think, how on earth did we end up talking like this? So we get sort of destinations that we have to reach in the course of this conversation, and we have to find a way between them, so that we will start in the pilot we did, we started at beer. We started with the subject of beer, and then we had to get to Napoleon via...
Not known to be a great drinker
no,
of beer.
No, we had to get there via Yellowstone National Park. So we have a central point that you have to reach. So it's just a kind of attempt to sort of structure one of those weird conversations that you have with friends where it wanders all over the place. But there's a weird logic to it, you know. So,
and when will we get to hear it?
It's on in the autumn. It's called Route Masters, because it's designed about trying to follow a route, a conversational route. But obviously, the idea really is just to facilitate a kind of interesting, slightly odd discussion, funny discussion that can sort of go anywhere.
And apart from that, and you're doing one or two other Radio 4 shows, because I was presenting them as well, you're doing stand-up.
We're doing a live show.
Now, can I ask you about that? Because, I mean, you know, I understand in a studio, even with a studio audience, you feel quite secure. There are other actors there. There's a script. There's a whole range of things. And then when you do stand-up, you walk onto a stage.
Yes.
I would be terrified. Yeah. Do you still get terrified?
I'd still get nervous, yeah. But I think that's... I sort of think that the day you stop getting nervous is the day you should stop, because if... you know, if you don't have any fear of the audience or any sort of, you know, there's adrenaline involved in comedy, and I think there's certainly adrenaline involved in topical comedy.
And now, do go to the loo beforehand, and I ask this question because Enoch Powell, the Tory politician, and it is said David Cameron, but I don't know about him, but I do know that Enoch Powell said this: never make a speech except on a full bladder.
Ah, right. What, so you don't go on too long?
No, because you're on edge all the way through.
You
are back, you know. And it was said that David Cameron, when he did his famous pitch to the Tory party to be leader, deliberately got himself in a situation, drank rather a lot of water, so you need to go to the loo. So it would be on sort of edge. That was for a shorter period. I suppose more difficult if you're doing. But how do you ginger yourself up to go on stage in that way?
Well, it's interesting you should say that thing about going to the loo, because it always reminds me of a horrendous time at Cambridge Corn Exchange where I did indeed head for the loo at the last minute before the show, but I had completely forgotten that I was wearing a radio microphone. And the sound engineer sort of had, he thought we were just off stage, just ready to come on.
Yeah.
So the radio microphone was on. And that is a lesson that you need to learn about. But it helps that there's two of you, I think, because if one is calm, the other won't be. So there's always a sort of shared jitteriness.
And you often hear about actors, for example, and I remember that very great actor Michael Gambon, who was an absolute nightmare about 3 or 4 weeks into a run, because he got bored, so he played mischief with his, you know, his leading actor or actress, whatever, and he never knew what they were going to do. Are you ever tempted to, how can I put this, create difficulties for Hugh Dennis when you're on stage together?
There is a certain amount of that. I mean, to be honest, our whole style comically was partly based on Hugh doing that to me, because our original personas comically was that I was quite earnest, and I was always trying to talk about sort of stand-up comedy style stuff, whereas Hugh would be sort of reacting to it or looking like, yeah, this is a bit boring, let's talk about something else, or he would...
rather like a bishop's son.
Yes, or he would produce some ridiculous prop or sort of take it on himself to sort of join in with a silly voice or something. And that sort of very vague double act structure of a slightly more earnest one who keeps trying to sort of talk about more serious things, and someone who's really just there to muck around, just sort of seemed to develop quite naturally. Neil Malarkey, the comedian, saw us quite early on doing a gig, and afterwards he said, "I see what you're doing there. You're doing Steve Punt and his naughty friend," which was, because that's the odd thing about ending up doing so much radio, is that our act was quite visual, because he likes clowning. We had a very early review that talked about how Hugh Dennis is a natural clown, and he would do lots of silly stuff with miming, and he used to do this thing where he'd button his coat suddenly over his head so it looked like he had no head. And we developed a whole routine out of that about ghosts, about famous ghosts and a headless horseman, and it was all very, very silly and very, very unsatirical. But I think that I began to share, as we did more and more radio and stuff, I began to share an observation that Jasper Carrot told me, which was that he did topical stuff on TV. You remember in the 80s, he did a series called Carrot's Lib, and then he did a series called Carrot Confidential, which we were in. And they were always topical. They were about the week's news. And he said, the reason I do that is because when I first did television, I used up 3 years of material in a week. You know, I did a big special for ITV, and I did all my best material, and it was gone. And I sort of quickly thought, do you know what? Actually, for broadcasting, it's better to do stuff that you just chuck at the wall, because it's more exciting, and it means that you can always use the magic of editing to get rid of anything that didn't work. And it sort of matches the medium, you know. To broadcasting is a very sort of ephemeral thing in a way, and the more it works comedically to have that sort of spontaneity, and the audience like hearing jokes about stuff that's just happened, it means that the subject matter is always fresh.
And it also means that when you go on tour and do stand-up, you're not doing topical jokes. You've kept fresh your own material, which people presumably in different theatres may... If you went and followed around the country, you'd hear, obviously, roughly the same show, But, you know, to each audience, you hope anyway, it's fresh.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's a really interesting thing there that we found consistently, which is a real sort of grass is greener syndrome, that when you're doing a tour show where it's basically the same basic show with sort of little topical additions and spontaneous stuff, but it's the same basic show every night, and you start thinking, oh, I wish we, you know, wish we could change one of this. We ought to do some more topical stuff. But when you're doing topical stuff and you're having to write the show from scratch every week, you sort of think, oh, I wish we had an actual show that we could just rehearse and learn and not have to just constantly be writing like this. So in a way, it's a way of giving ourselves a bit of the best of both worlds.
And you're not going to stop, are you? I mean, you are, I think, as I say, still you could be legally my son, but you are a little older than some, as Radio 4 has just told you. But have you, yes. Are you going to stop at all? I mean...
Well, I think the situation for a long time now, I've thought I would like to be in a situation where I don't have to stop, but if I do have to stop, then that's fine. You know, I don't want to be having to go and work in Tesco's because I've not able to stop. So I'm a fairly sensible sort of chap in that respect. So I don't want to stop, but if the public essentially tell us to stop by not turning up, then I won't have to go back to paper round.
You're suggesting that you're at least reasonably financially secure. Well, anyway, I'm sure...
It's really more that I made the shrewd move of buying a house in the mid-90s. But it's one of those things where you don't want to outstay your welcome. But Radio 4 actually is an interesting place to work in that respect, because Hugh and I both used to... No, Barry Cryer, he, along with many comedians, he would phone me up immediately after the Now Show had gone out on Saturday and tell me a joke and stuff. And he was still going, literally right up to the last moment. He was still doing Clue. I saw him in Edinburgh when he was well into his 70s, doing a really, really funny show where he just sat and told jokes for an hour. And but it was immensely entertaining. So I don't think there's any reason for comedians to stop. The only reason to stop is if people aren't laughing, which seems to me to be a big hint that perhaps...
Well, I'm sure they won't. And please don't stop. And genuinely, from a fan, thank you so much for the Now Show. I looked forward to it so much. I enjoyed it so much. It never let me down.
Well, you know, I was saying to Hugh the other day is that I suspect that the time I will really miss it is in the autumn, because, of course, we wouldn't normally be on back on until October anyway. So I think when it gets to October... And the politicians start doing stupid things and people start saying, oh, you can use this in your programme. Then I think I probably will miss it for a while yet.
Well, we will as well. Steve Punt, thank you very much for joining us. My thanks to Steve Punt. And like our podcast, Steve's new venture with Hugh Dennis has the backing of the BBC coffers. Please do consider supporting our endeavours for less than a cup of coffee per month by signing up to patreon.com/bwatch for just £1.99 per month. You will also receive a weekly blog, which gives my take on the week's interview. You'll be able to find the link to this in the description of the programme. And that's it for this week. As you know, this podcast is presented by me, Roger Bolton, and it's produced by Kate Dixon. The sound is by Dave Kitto, and special thanks to Quinn Genty. It's a Good Egg production. Until next time. Goodbye.